Welcome back to the deep dive. We're doing something a little unusual today.
Yeah, a bit off the beaten path for us.
Exactly. Because usually when we tackle a dense scientific text here, we focus on the core chapters, the big theories.
The case studies, the stuff that gets all the headlines.
Right. And we almost instinctively ignore the appendices.
It is a habit.
Yeah.
I mean, you see Appendix A at the back of a book, and your brain just sort of switches off. You think, okay, that's just the dusty reference library in the basement.
Yeah.
I'll go down there only if I get absolutely desperate.
Exactly. It feels like the terms and conditions section of a contract. But today, we are exclusively exploring that basement. We're looking at the appendices to each KDH Badeshia's book, Geometry of Crystals and Phase Transformations. Hmm. And having spent some time with this, I've realized that describing it as dusty reference material it's completely wrong.
It's completely wrong. In a book about how the physical structure of matter changes, like how crystals rearrange themselves or how steel hardens the math in the appendices, isn't just a footnote.
No.
It's the engine room. It is the foundation that holds the entire building up.
That's the exact feeling I got. We are looking specifically at Appendix A and B today. And I have to be honest with you, the listener here, visually, it is intimidating.
Oh, yeah.
You flip to these pages and it's bold letters, Greek symbols, subscripts, and just grid after grid of numbers. It looks like hieroglyphics to the uninitiated.
It really does.
But our mission today is to decode that, because what Padeshi is actually giving us here is basically the source code for 3D space.
That's a great way to frame it. Because think about it. If you want to understand how a material transforms, say, how a shape memory alloy remembers its original shape after you bend it, you can't just describe that with vague words.
Right. You can't just say it twists back.
Exactly. You have to describe it with rigorous geometry. You need a mathematical toolkit that lets you rotate, stretch, and map objects in three dimensions without losing track of where every single atom is supposed to be.
So we are going to strip away the complex notation today and find the logic underneath.
Let's do it.
We're going to move from the most basic unit, the simple arrow, up to the grid, and finally to some pretty complex 3D gymnastics involving rotation matrices. So let's start with the building blocks. Appendix A.1. The vector.
The fundamental unit of spatial math.
Now, most people have a high school memory of vectors. It's an arrow, it has a length and a direction.
Right.
Padeshi defines it as a quantity characterized by magnitude and direction, contrasting it with the scalar. Can we clarify that distinction first?
Sure. So a scalar is just a number. It has magnitude but no direction at all. Temperature is a scalar.
Okay.
It's 20 degrees. It's not 20 degrees north. Time is a scalar. But a vector forces you to ask which way.
Like displacement.
Exactly. Think of displacement. If I tell you to move a chair 5 feet port, you can't follow that instruction. You're stuck. You need to know 5 feet where. To the left. Towards the door.
That distinction is intuitive, but where the text gets specific and where I think people get tripped up is how we treat these arrows mathematically. It emphasizes that two vectors are only equal if both components match perfectly. Same length. Same direction.
Correct. And this is rigid. You can have two arrows of identical length, say 5 centimeters.
Right.
But if one points north and the other points northeast, they're completely different mathematical entities.
They aren't kind of equal.
No, they are distinct.
The notation uses this double vertical line for parallel vectors. But I found the concept of the negative vector really interesting. The text says if you have vector u and vector x equals negative u, they're parallel, but what does that actually mean physically?
It means they're anti-parallel. Picture a line on the floor. Both vectors lie on that exact same line. They have the exact same length, but the arrowhead is on the opposite end.
Oh.
One points forward, one points backward.
So the negative sign in vector math isn't about value, strictly speaking. It's not like a negative bank account. It's about orientation.
Precisely. It is a 180-degree flip. And this becomes really important when you start adding them up. The text describes vector addition using the tip-to-tail method.
Which is basically mapping a journey, right? I loved this visualization.
It's exactly a journey. Imagine vector A is walk 5 steps north. You stop there. Then vector B is walk 3 steps east.
So you start walking east from where you just stopped.
Right. The sum of those vectors, A plus B, is the straight line connecting your original starting point to where you ended up. It's the as the crow flies shortcut.
Okay, so that's the arrow in isolation. But arrows don't exist in a void. We need to describe where they are. This brings us to the frame of reference. The text talks about basis vectors, a 1, a 2, a 3.
Imagine trying to describe the location of a fly buzzing around in your room. you implicitly use the corner of the room as your reference point.
Right.
You have the line where the two walls meet and the lines where the walls meet the floor. Those are your basis vectors. In crystallography, we can pick any three vectors to define a grid as long as they don't all lie flat on the same sheet of paper. They have to be non-coplanar.
But not all grids are created equal. The text draws a hard line between orthogonal and orthonormal.
Yes, it does.
I know I've used these interchangeably in the past, but Padeshi is very specific here. Why the distinction?
You definitely want to keep them separate. Orthogonal just means perpendicular. If your three basis vectors meet at 90-degree angles, like the corner of a standard room, your basis is orthogonal. That's good. That's a nice square grid.
Okay. And orthonormal?
Normal refers to normalized. It means the length of every basis vector is exactly one. It's a standard unit. So an orthonormal basis is the gold standard. Everything is at 90 degrees and every ruler is the exact same length.
Why does that distinction matter so much in the actual math? Why can't we just use weird rulers?
You can, but it makes your life miserable. Mm-hmm. If your rulers are different lengths or if the walls aren't at 90 degrees, calculating a simple distance becomes a nightmare of trigonometry.
No, oh, I see.
You have to account for the slant and the scale. But if you have an orthonormal basis, distance is just the Pythagorean theorem. X squared plus Y squared plus Z squared. It simplifies the universe.
I'm all for simplifying the universe. That leads us to how these vectors interact with each other. The text introduces two ways to multiply them, the dot product and the cross product.
This is often where students get tripped up, but physically there are very distinct actions with very different meanings.
Let's break them down. The dot product first. That's a scalar product. You multiply two vectors and get a single number. The text describes it as the magnitude of u times the magnitude of x times the cosine of theta.
Think of the dot product as a shadow. It measures how much of one vector is pointing in the same direction as the other.
Yeah.
If I shine a light straight down on vector A, how much of a shadow does vector B cast onto it? It's a measure of parallelism.
So if they're perpendicular,
the shadow is zero. The dot product is zero. They have nothing in common direction-wise. It's a way of asking, do these two things agree?
Then we have the cross product. This doesn't give you a number. It gives you a brand new vector.
Yes. If the dot product is about parallel interaction, the cross product is about perpendicular generation. When you cross vector u and vector x, you create a third vector that shoots out perpendicular to both of them.
The text uses a very specific tactile analogy here, the right-handed screw. I actually paused to try this out with my hand.
I love this because it connects abstract math to hardware store physics. Imagine a standard screw. If you rotate it from the first vector towards the second vector, the direction the screw moves driving into the water backing out is the direction of your new vector.
It's such a solid way to visualize it. You're turning something around, but the result is motion forward.
That's exactly what happens. The magnitude of that new vector equals the area of the parallelogram formed by the first two. Mm-hmm. So the cross product gives you an area and a direction perpendicular to that area.
And finally, a text combines these into the scalar triple product. U dot, open parenthesis, x, cross z, close parenthesis, which sounds terrifying.
It sounds fancy, but it's just geometry. You take the area from the cross product, and you project the third vector onto it, physically. It calculates the volume of the box, the parallel piped, formed by those three vectors.
So it's just a volume calculator?
Literally just a volume calculator for a slanted box.
Okay, we've mastered the arrow, now we have to upgrade. We're moving to appendix A.2. Matrices.
The grid.
To me, a matrix J just looks like a spreadsheet. It's rows and columns of numbers. But in this context, we shouldn't look at it as data storage, should we?
No. In physics and crystallography, a matrix is a machine. It's an operator. You feed a vector into one side of the matrix chews on it, and spits out a transformed vector on the other side.
It changes it.
It might rotate it, stretch it, or shear it. It's an active participant.
Before we turn the machine on, we need to understand the parts. The text defines a few key terms. The transpose flipping the rows to columns, the trace summing up the diagonal numbers, and the identity matrix.
The identity matrix is crucial. It's a matrix with ones down the diagonal and zeros everywhere else. Yeah. It is the matrix equivalent of the number one. If you multiply a vector by the identity matrix, absolutely nothing happens. It comes out exactly as it went in.
It's the do-nothing machine. Now, in the middle of these definitions, Padeshi throws in a note about the Einstein summation convention.
Ah, yes. the physicist's best friend.
It sounds incredibly complex, like you need a PhD just to use the notation, but reading the text, it seems like just a shorthand.
It is purely a shorthand for efficiency. When you are doing matrix math, you are constantly adding things up. Row 1 times column 1 plus row 2 times column 2 and so on.
Yeah.
It takes forever to write out the sigma symbol for sum every single time. You'd run out of ink.
So Einstein said, let's just skip it.
Basically, the rule is if you see an index like the letter I repeated in a single term, you automatically assume we are summing over it.
Okay.
So you I times a subscript. I just mean sum up all the U times of pairs. It declutters the page so you can see the actual physics structure without getting lost in a sea of plus signs.
I appreciate the decluttering because matrix multiplication gets messy. And the text has a warning label here. Order matters. J times K is not the same as K times J.
This is non-commutative algebra. And it makes sense physically.
Mm.
Imagine your two matrices represent actions. Matrix A is rotate 90 degrees. Matrix B is squash it flat like a pancake.
Okay.
If I rotate the object and then squash it, I get a flat pancake oriented one way. If I squash it first and then try to rotate the pancake, I might end up with a completely different result in space.
The sequence of events changes the outcome.
Exactly.
That is a really clear way to put it. Now we have to talk about the determinant. The text gives a formula involving minors and cofactors, which we don't need to recite on air, but conceptually, what is the determinant telling us about our matrix machine?
The determinant is the scaling factor of the transformation. It tells you how much the matrix changes the volume of the object it's acting on.
So if the determinant is 2?
The volume doubles. It stretches space.
And if the determinant is 0?
The volume becomes 0. You have taken a 3D object and smashed it onto a flat plane or even a line. You've lost a dimension.
And that is what the text calls singular.
Right. A singular matrix destroys information because you flatten the object. You can't figure out what it looked like originally. You can't reverse the process.
Which means it has no inverse.
Exactly. The inverse matrix J to the negative 1 is the undo button. It reverses the transformation. But you can't undo a pancake back into a sphere if you've lost the depth data. Mathematically, the formula for the inverse requires dividing by the determinant.
And if the determinant is 0?
You're dividing by 0. Game over.
Game over, the math breaks.
Yes.
Fortunately for crystallography, which is what this book is actually about, we deal with a very well-behaved class of matrices. The text highlights orthogonal matrices in Appendix 8.2.4. Why are these the VIPs?
Because crystals are solids. When you rotate a crystal to look at it from a different angle, it doesn't melt, it doesn't stretch, it stays a rigid body.
So an orthogonal matrix represents a rigid rotation.
Yes. It rotates the coordinates, but it preserves lengths and angles. And because of that, it has magical properties. The most important one is that the inverse is just the transpose.
Wait, let me make sure I caught that. Instead of doing that massive calculation with cofactors and determinants to find the undo button, you just flip the rows and columns.
That's it. For an orthogonal matrix, the inverse equals the transpose. It makes the computational load vanishingly small. It's a beautiful shortcut.
The text also notes that the determinant of these matrices is always positive 1 or negative 1.
Right. Positive 1 means a pure rotation. You just spun the object. Negative 1 implies a reflection, like looking in a mirror.
Oh, I see.
It's still rigid. You haven't squashed it.
Uh-huh.
But the handedness is flipped. Left becomes right.
Okay, so we have the basics. We have the arrows. We have the machines. Now we get to the real deep dive section. Appendix B, general rotation matrices.
This is where the training wheels come off.
The problem is simple to state. We want to rotate a crystal. If we rotate it around the z-axis or the 0, 0, 1 direction, the math is easy. It's simple sines and cosines. We learned that in high school.
Right. Rotating around a vertical pole is easy. The equations are short.
But nature doesn't care about our easy axes. What if we need to rotate the crystal 37 degrees around some weird arbitrary axis like 1, 2, 3?
That is a nightmare calculation. You cannot just plug it into the simple formulas because the axis is diagonal across space.
The text provides equation B.1 for this.
Okay.
I'm looking at it right now. It is a wall of algebra. It takes up a quarter of the page. It has U1, U2, U3, lots of cosines, 1 minus cosine theta terms. It looks like a mess.
It does.
It looks like something you'd see in a movie to show that a character is a genius.
It is a beast. But the way Badeshi derives this formula is honestly the most valuable takeaway from this entire text. It's a masterclass in problem solving.
He uses something called a similarity transformation. The notation is GR equals JRJ prime. It looks like a sandwich.
It is a sandwich. Or maybe a portal.
Mm.
Here's the logic. you have a hard problem rotating around a weird axis. You don't know how to do that directly, but you do know how to rotate around the simple z-axis.
So you cheat.
You cheat intelligently. Step one, you apply a matrix J. This transforms your entire coordinate system. It reorients the universe so that your weird diagonal axis lies perfectly on top of the simple z-axis.
You move the world to make the problem easy.
Exactly. You twist the perspective. Now that the axis is lined up with z step two, you apply R. This is the simple rotation we know how to do. You twist it around the axis.
But now the world is in the wrong place. We moved it.
Right. So step three, you apply J prime the inverse. You transform the coordinate system back to where it started.
Yeah, if you move the frame, yeah. The easy twist, move the frame back.
And if you multiply those three matrices together, J times R times J prime, the result is that giant complex formula B point one.
Wow.
That single matrix now contains the DNA of the entire complex maneuver. It condenses the whole three-step journey into one package.
That is incredibly satisfying. It essentially says that complexity is just a matter of perspective. If you change your perspective, the operation becomes simple.
That's the core philosophy of linear algebra. You change the basis to make the operator simple. It's a divide-and-conquer strategy for math.
Now, there is one last detective trick in the text that I loved. Let's say you are working backward. You have a grid of numbers, a rotation matrix, and you have no idea what it represents. You just have the data. How do you figure out the angle of rotation?
You don't need to solve the whole huge equation. You just look at the trace. Remember the sum of the diagonal numbers? It turns out for any rotation matrix, the trace always equals 1 plus 2 times the cosine of theta.
That is shockingly simple. You sum three numbers, subtract 1, divide by 2, and you have the cosine of your angle.
It's robust. It works every time. It cuts through the noise.
And finding the axis.
You look at the off-diagonal terms. You take the differences like row 2, column 3, minus row 3, column 2. Those differences correspond directly to the components of the axis vector.
So the matrix is hiding the answer in plain sight.
Always. You just need to know where to look.
The text wraps up with a brief mention of Euler angles.
Yeah, that's an alternative method. Instead of one axis, one angle, Euler breaks it down into three separate rotations in sequence. Rotate around X, then around the new Z, then around the new X.
Right.
It's useful, and it's used a lot in robotics and aerospace, but as we discussed earlier, order matters, so you have to be very careful with the sequence. If you get the sequence wrong, you end up pointing in the wrong direction.
This has been quite the journey. We started with a simple arrow on a page and ended up manipulating 3D space with similarity transformations.
It shows you why you shouldn't skip the appendices. This isn't just extra stuff. This is the grammar of the language of material science. You cannot write the poetry of phase transformations if you don't know the grammar of matrix algebra.
I think my biggest takeaway is that concept of the similarity transformation, JRJ prime, the idea that you can solve a difficult problem by translating it into an easy frame of reference, solving it and translating it back. That is a mental model I'm going to use outside of crystallography.
It's a powerful tool for life, not just math. Sometimes you just need to shift your perspective to make the impossible possible.
I want to leave you, the listener, with a small challenge inspired by the text. Padeshia uses that right-handed screw analogy for the cross product.
Yes.
The next time you are opening a jar or driving a screw into a wall, take a second to look at your hand, watch the rotation, and then visualize the vector shooting out perpendicular to that rotation.
Connect the abstract math to the physical force you are exerting.
Exactly. That invisible vector is what's holding your bookshelf up. Thanks for diving deep into the math with us today.
Always a pleasure.
We will catch you on the next deep dive.